They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
Hello and welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast. This is Artie, and today two people who haven't been on the podcast before are podcasting with me, who are Sarah and Amy. Hello. We have a very special guest, namely Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes series.
And I have to say, I love the idea of there being babes on Baker Street.
Thank you very much. There is this thing that we do on the podcast, which is a bit of a silly thing, but everyone has to go through it. It's a rite of passage. Basically, we ask these three questions to just get to know people. So those three questions are, how did you get into Sherlock Holmes? What's your favourite story? And what's your favourite adaptation?
Well, I have to say I'm all in favour of silliness, having just published a book about pirates. So,
Brilliant. Good start.
Silliness is good. I probably met Sherlock Holmes when I was a student, but don't really remember reading whatever it was that one reads in high school. Probably Hound of the Baskervilles. But I met him as a character, as an adult, when I was starting to write the Mary Russell stories. I sat down to write a sort of coming-of-age story about a young woman with an extraordinary mind and found myself writing the sentence, I was 15 when I first met Sherlock Holmes, 15 years old with my nose in a book as I walked the Sussex Downs and nearly stepped on him. And at that point, I had to stop and think, I really don't know anything about Sherlock Holmes. So I had to go out and buy the collected works. At the time, there was a two-volume mass market-size paperback, very, very small print that had all 56 short stories and four novels. And I read my way through them as, you know, with a lot of surprise because I had not expected them to be about a character with that much complexity. You tend to see books that you know about secondhand as if they were kids' books, as if they were very simple, two-dimensional stories about a thinking machine, as it were. And I found that the character that Conan Doyle talks about has a lot more depth to him than I had expected, both in the sense that he is a passionate individual and that there is a lot of humor in the stories, neither of which I'd really expected to find. As for my favorite story, I suppose that I ought to choose that which is my BSI name, The Red Circle. And it's not a bad choice because it has a lot of the elements of the Holmes story. He's bored. He's not really interested in all the bits and pieces of crime that the city throws at him. He gets involved with something that's much more complicated than he had anticipated that actually gets his interest. There are damsels in distress and dastardly doings and a vicious villain. And it has a lovely bit where he goes into details about the agony column in London, which is one of the sort of classic images of Holmes perusing the agony column in the London papers. So I'd have to say at the moment, The Red Circle is probably as good as any other. Mm. And what was the third element of your silly question?
What's your favorite adaptation?
Oh, the adaptation. Oh, yes. Well, any number of them. I suppose it would depend on whether you mean faithful adaptations, in which case probably Jeremy Brett ones, the Granada television ones, or the sort of pastiche ones that use the stories as a springboard. And those would have to be the most recent BBC productions called Sherlock with the gloriously named Benedict Cumberbatch. I like those because they really capture the essence of the character, and they also I think, have the best Watson that I have seen on the screen. He's really an expertly drawn character. And that particular version of Watson goes a long way to explain why Holmes bonded with him, I think.
Thank you very, very much. Those of you who listen to this podcast know that I love the BBC's Watson quite a bit. So this makes me happy.
We're looking forward to the next triplet of shows that I think are here much later than you get them over there.
Well, Mark Gatiss said today they hand them to the BBC in November, and then the BBC decide when they're going to show them. So it's all up in the air for us as well as you.
We shall be patient.
We will indeed. So how did you come up with Russell in the first place? I think you've touched on that in your earlier answer.
Yeah, Mary Russell was a response to the traditional view of Sherlock Holmes as being this completely brilliant thinking machine. Whereas when you take a step back and look at much of what he does, it's what, if a woman did it, would be dismissed as mere feminine intuition.
Mm.
So I thought, you know, I really need to explore this idea a little further of what would that mind look like if it were housed in a different person, if it were not a middle-aged Victorian male with an appreciative audience in the background saying, "Oh, Holmes, how do you do it?" But instead a young woman who to whom that manner of thinking is quite natural, and who doesn't have this little chorus of people saying, "How do you do it?" Her chorus consists of people who are just merely irritated with her. So that was where Russell came from. And because it's always more interesting to put similar things near each other rather than transplant them entirely. I mean, I could conceivably have written the Russell books with Russell as a detective in the later end of the 20th century. But I thought it was more interesting to put her next to Holmes, which pretty much gave me the time and place for them. You know, I needed to have Holmes free of the Conan Doyle stories. So I sat down in the beginning of the Great War, 1915. Mm-hmm. And she comes into his life when he is in his late 50s or early 60s. Depending on what chronology you go by. And the two of them have much to teach each other. That's where Russell comes from.
Excellent. Fab. Thank you very much. I'm going to hand over to Sarah, because you have some questions. I don't want to do all the asking.
Okay. I actually mislaid my list of questions, so I was frantically trying to reconstruct it.
All for the better. Let's be spontaneous.
Spontaneous. All right. I'm curious about the direction the series is going, whether you plan to sort of carry on indefinitely or go back and fill in some of these empty spaces the way you did with O Jerusalem. Do you foresee an end, or do you just plan to carry on as long as you're allowed?
The question is based on the assumption that I know what I'm doing. Which honestly is a very rash assumption. For example, the one that is just published came out of an unexpected time in Lisbon, followed by an unexpected 10 days in Morocco. And the entire book was shaped on both of those elements, which I had not intended even 9 months before, much less, you know, when I first started the series. There are probably going to be a number of the sort of fill-in books that will be in two parts. For example, in the beginning of Locked Rooms, there is mention of Holmes and Russell pausing on their way between India and California to do a job for the Emperor of Japan.
And that was one of the things that I was actually wondering about when I was reading it.
Yeah, well, it was, I would like to do a book set in historical Japan. And I thought, why not make it a Russell and Holmes story? But since I had not at the time been to Japan, and indeed have not yet been to Japan, difficult to write a story set there. So I planted that in there, figuring that what I would do is have a sort of two-part book with a portion of it, the case in Japan, and a portion of it, whatever catches up with them once they get back, probably the beginning of 1925. So the two halves of the book will be a year apart, but it'll sort of function like O Jerusalem and Justice Hall did, except probably it won't be two volumes. It might be. It depends on what I come up with as I'm writing, which, since I clearly do not know what I'm doing, I have no idea what those stories will be. This is the sort of thing that keeps my editor on her toes.
Oh, dear.
You don't want to become too dependable here.
You've mentioned your latest book and the unexpected time in Lisbon, so I think this is a good time for you to tell us a little bit about The Pirate King, which is the latest book. I mean, you've spent the last 2 weeks pretty much talking a lot about Pirate King, but if you could do it again for us, that would be excellent.
Well, unlike the events that I've done over the last 2 weeks, I will not require the three of you to join me in a sing-along. This rather surprised a number of the bookstores that hadn't got the memo that we were starting out with a sing-along based on a version of the Major General song, which the words of it, if you're interested, the words of it are on the website. So the Major Criminal song, we'll just take that as having been sung, okay? Because I'm not going to do it now. No, I wanted to do a book that was different. I wanted to take the series, which had reached the point of 10 novels, and step back and look at it a little, because when you have a series that doesn't have a specific arc to it, that is, you're not working towards an end point, you have to look at it with an analytic eye every so often and see where it's going and where you want it to go. Now, the last two books in the series, Language of Bees and God of the Hive, seemed to me to be getting away from the sort of whimsical beginnings of the Russell series. They were really fairly straight suspense novels without any of the silliness of the earlier books. And although I think they work fine as, especially as a pair of suspense novels, the latter of the two is almost a thriller in its structure. I wanted to more or less hit the reset button. I wanted to change things around a little bit and thought, how about if I do a farce? So that's where I started with this book. And most of the readers seem to have got it. There have been a few comments of people who just really don't get the humor, which, you know, humor is a very individual sort of thing. And especially when you're dealing with Gilbert and Sullivan, which I find really quite funny, but other people think, oh, dear, Laurie's really lost it this time. There's various somewhat over-the-top scenes in the book, but it is a straightforward crime fiction novel with humor. So that's what I was aiming at. It starts out by Russell getting dragged into a motion picture production, and this being 1924, these are silent films. A motion picture production about a motion picture production about the Pirates of Penzance. So she gets dumped into the middle of this film crew with the task of shepherding the 13, some of them very young, blonde actresses who play the Major General's daughters. And on the other hand, she's also watching for signs of some kind of criminal activity. This is her assignment there. But things never go right with something like this. And so she ends up with a lot more on her hands than she had originally anticipated.
That sounds like fun.
I had fun. And it was particularly fun because it meant at the events, a lot of people dressed up as pirates. So we had a number of pirates that we had at the events, and I gave away the movie poster that we made. There's a movie poster that you can also see online of Pirate King, the movie version, original 1924 poster, starring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes.
Seen the trailer as well. That was
fun. Oh, yes, that's fun. They did a good job with the trailer, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Can we talk about women and Blondes and what you have to say about women and Sherlock Holmes, especially given Language of Bees and God of the Hive. I think we're not going to get around this one.
Well, I tend to write mostly about women. I have a couple books that are written from the male point of view. But for the most part, I tend to write about women. Women's minds interest me more. So most of the Russell books tend to be about, not about women, but with women playing central roles. I guess that Pirate King is no less than that, simply because you have this bevy of young women in there. One of the reviews that I got pointed out that one of the themes in my writing is the tendency of people to overlook blondes. Which I thought was a nice touch, although I'm not quite sure that it's limited to blondes. But since Mary Russell is more or less blonde, I suppose it counts. One of the interesting things about the Conan Doyle stories is Holmes's attitude towards women, because he's generally assumed to be misogynistic. But in fact, he's more of a general misanthrope. He doesn't like anybody. And the people who get the better of him, such as Irene Adler, are women. I mean, not always, but Irene Adler is the one character who really, really soundly trounces him at his own game.
Yeah.
And gives him a degree of humility that he had not had before. Which I love this image, you know, written by this male Victorian writer about a male Victorian detective. And that probably was one of the defining wishes in my envisioning Mary Russell. That is, that she was somebody who would indeed regularly get the better of a person who is generally assumed to be the greatest mind in the world, including by himself. So the scenes where she gets the better of him are always the fun scenes to write, and I think to read as well. I think that's one of the reasons people like the books, is she occasionally manages to soundly trounce him at mental gymnastics.
Yeah. Speaking for myself, I can definitely tell you that's, yeah, most fun.
Yeah, and it starts at the very beginning where he overlooks the fact that she's a young woman. And she declares, well, if that's what's left of the great detective's mind, and whips off her hat and displays her long blonde plait. In 1915, few young men would have. It was fun to write that meeting scene from Holmes's point of view in the novella that I did, that my publishers asked me to do an e-novella.
Oh, yeah, Beekeeping for Beginners.
Yeah, and it was fun to revisit that early, early meeting from Holmes's point of view. I had a lot of enjoyment with that. The surprise, I think, went on both sides.
Fab, yeah, that was a great scene. What an introduction to the character.
Yeah, which more or less is how Russell introduced herself to me. I didn't really plan out the character. I didn't think, well, she needs to be this and she should be American because some of my vocabulary is going to give me away as a writer. And she should be interested in theology because that's my background. It was more that she simply walked into my life, my mind, and onto the page, which is rare and a great gift for a writer, to have a character who just sort of sets herself down fully formed without a lot of planning. So I met her in the way that I think others meet her. Just she stomps onto the page and takes over the narrative.
And she does it very well.
Thank you.
Well, I think I speak for at least the three of us. Okay, Amy.
Yes, Laurie, I want to ask you, I know that there's always been a sort of cultural awareness of Holmes for a long time, but obviously in the last couple of years, we've seen a huge resurgence with films, new editions of the works, obviously the BBC series. I hear recently that there's going to be a new Russian series. I just wonder, what are your thoughts on sort of the recent massive explosion of the Holmes fandom?
I would suppose that it's the same, has the same roots as the appreciation for crime fiction in general. I mean, if you look at the bestseller lists of general fiction, you will see that an awful lot of titles on there could, even if they're not, be classified as crime fiction. And I think that the form of the mystery is something that people find very appealing. For one thing, it has a plot, whereas a lot of mainstream fiction does not. A lot of mainstream fiction simply wanders on through people's lives for a period of time and then stops. Whereas with a mystery, a thriller, a suspense novel, you're telling a story. It is storytelling at its purest. You have a challenge, you have problems that come up, you have varying degrees of hazard, and you have a solution. And I think that the solution of the problem is one of the real appeals in crime fiction, that you set things aright before the book closes. Probably the same applies to the other media, whether it's television or movies or whatever. The classic image of Holmes as being a single man who throws his abilities, mostly mental, against huge problems and comes out on the top is very appealing for people who are feeling lost, abandoned by the traditional support networks in the world. And of course, the business of your hero in fiction is someone that the reader or the viewer is meant to step into their shoes. The hero is you on the screen, in the page. And it's a very appealing role for people. Be one individual fighting against a huge conglomerate, against a mysterious puzzle, against hidden forces. And the fact that they're historical is probably one of the appeals. It's a time with a lot of flavor to it. It's the Victorian, early Edwardian era.
Excellent. Would you ever be interested in seeing Mary Russell on screen?
Well, it's something that we talk about a lot. I have two agents who are often in conversation with various peoples about doing things. There's various issues that come up when you are talking about adapting a novel format into a screen format. Because for one thing, the novels that I write are fairly complicated. There's a lot of character interaction, a lot of development. Plots tend to have a lot of subplots. It's really tough to do in a two-hour film, even in a television series. So that there would be problems in how to hack stuff out, how to reduce the amount of undergrowth to a single storyline. And there's also the question of if you're doing something that's historical in the 20s, it's tough to film it anywhere other than, for example, Eastern Europe has a number of neighborhoods and buildings that give you the kind of backdrop you need. Whereas, for example, the Granada series, the Jeremy Brett series ended up building, London.
Did they?
It's a little expensive that way.
Yeah, speaking of the series and of plot and how long it is and how difficult it is to hack up, did you ever think when you first started out that it would go on as long as it has done now? Did you initially plan for a number of novels, or how did it work when you first started out?
I think it's obvious that The Beekeeper's Apprentice only makes sense as the beginning of a series. Some of the stuff that I do, the standalones and the first of the Martinellis, could be considered individual novels. But The Beekeeper's Apprentice really only makes sense as the first in a series. So I think from the beginning, I was picturing it as a series of stories. Whether I would have thought that, you know, 15 years later, I'm still writing them, I don't know. The idea that people would actually buy a book that you write is pretty foreign to most first-time writers. The idea of actually being on bestseller lists is a fantasy, but very clearly a fantasy. you know, it's lovely to have it happen. I somehow still don't take it all in.
Thank you very much. You've mentioned Kay Martinelli there, which is a brilliant segue into the next question. I think it came from Sarah.
Yes. I believe I've seen you mention before that you do occasionally have ideas for the Martinelli series or for other novels, but that the demand at the moment seems to be for Russell. Are you ever tempted to just tell her to sort of sit quietly in Sussex for a while I go do something else?
The thought of telling Russell to do anything is really quite exciting. Much less sit quietly. Yeah, sure, that's going to work. I have these yearly discussions with my editor about what the next year's book will be. And because of the current problems in the publishing world, it's really tough to branch out and do something new and different, especially if you know that it's not going to be as numerically popular as an established series. So the last couple of years, of course, I did Language of Bees and God of the Hive, which really had to be put together because they were linked. They were a two-part novel, as it were. And I was happy to do a third one because it enabled me to do something very, very different. I don't mind writing the same character one year to the next if I am doing something different, whether it's a different place, a different tone, different characters. So that over the last three books, I've done one fairly straightforward suspense novel, one that is really a thriller in structure, and then this one, which is a comic novel. And the difference in location and character and structure gave me a different writing experience each time, which is what I badly need to keep my mind and my interest fresh. Mm. When we had the what am I writing next discussion a year ago, and my editor said, I'd really like you to do another Russell, she more or less assumed that I wouldn't. However, one of the things that really interested me in writing Pirate King was this 10 days that I spent in Morocco a year and a half ago that just fascinated me. I mean, as a country, as a people, as a potential place to put a book. And one of the problems with Pirate King was that I only could use a very small place in there because they go to Morocco and they are in this one place the whole time. So I thought, I would really like to write a book about Fez. It's the most fascinating city in the world. And I'd like to write it while it's still relatively fresh in my mind. So that when my editor said, oh, we'd really like you to do, I said, okay. Which she then picked herself up from the ground. And I said, I'd really like to do one turning Russell loose in Fez. So that next year's book will be called Garment of Shadows, and it's set in northern Morocco, the city of Fez, and up in the mountains, the Reef Mountains, where in 1924 there was this revolt conveniently going on for me. And so she gets involved in this, the Reef Rebellion and the French protectorate and all the rest of it. So it's great fun and really, really a lot of fun to write that exotic a setting. I mean, it's just nothing about Feds that isn't fascinating. So I had a lot of fun with that. But the next year, the next book that I'll be doing will not be a Russell. It will be, I think, a sequel to the book that I did in 2007 called Touchstone, which is also historical. This, I think, will be set in 1928. Touchstone was set in 1926 during the general strike in England. And this one, I think, will be probably Paris in 1928 or 9. I haven't quite narrowed it down yet. Writing in a different voice, in even a different person, because that'll be third person, writing a different time and a place really helps restore me if I come back to Russell the following year. Whether Martinelli will get another book anytime soon, I don't really know. I think I'd like to do another two or three in that series. Whether I can convince them that it's economically feasible will depend on a lot of things. But I would like to do that. If I had all kinds of time free, I would probably write one and just edit the hell out of it myself and put it up as an ebook. But there's a lot of problems with that. One is that I don't have that kind of free time. And the other is I'm very dependent on my editor. She makes my books better. And to write a solitary ebook without her input would be really tough.
Yeah. Right. Well, Kate Martinelli and Russell have been sort of in one book together, haven't they?
Well, yeah. Whenever publishing wants you to do something that they know you're not going to want to, they blame it on sales. The sales department always has these wishes and disapprovals that you sort of wonder if anyone ever actually consulted with the sales department. But you'll hear things like, oh, sales just says they can't sell a book set in Australia, or sales would really love it if you could do a book that combines the Russell and the Martinelli. Well, my instant reaction to that is, what, you want me to write a book where Kate Martinelli arrests 110-year-old Mary Russell for murder? And I thought, you know, I'm an imaginative writer, but even I have my limits. So I told her no, I couldn't do that. But I thought about it and called her back a week or two later, and I said, you know, I really can't see a way to bring the characters of Russell and Martinelli together, but I can bring the storylines so that they overlap. And, you know, as it worked out, Martinelli finding a Sherlock Holmes story set in San Francisco in 1924 made it work. And I always love it when this synchronicity rears its head and brings me things such as Conan Doyle's trip through San Francisco the year before, 1923, where he had many rude things to say about San Francisco because they were not quite as, shall we say, gullible as Los Angeles had proven on his way up the coast. And so it was possible that he would write a sort of rude Sherlock Holmes story while he was in San Francisco and leave it here and not publish it because it's about many, you know, many things that San Franciscans would find amusing, but the rest of the world would find shocking. So it's possible that Conan Doyle could have written this short story and abandoned it. On the other hand, it's quite possible that if Holmes and Russell had been in San Francisco themselves in 1924, they could have had this adventure, and Holmes himself could have written it up and left it in the house. So there's many interesting possibilities in that kind of story. And, of course, Kate Martinelli, who is not a Sherlockian herself, assumes that this is some mad short story that Conan Doyle whipped off and left, and thinks that this whole business of Sherlock Holmes fans is really quite nuts.
However could anyone get the idea that we're crazy?
I cannot imagine.
We've mentioned Russell on screen before. If you could have Russell on screen and if you could cast, who would you cast as Russell and Holmes?
Oh, I think a lot of that would depend on finding a young actress who could play the part of, you know, a 15-year-old and a 20-something-year-old. I haven't seen anyone who comes immediately to mind, but there's new people coming along all the time, so I, you know, that, fortunately, that's not my job.
Fair enough.
There's any number of people who could play Holmes. I always thought Captain Picard would make a great Sherlock Holmes.
Patrick Stewart.
He has the kind of humor and the quick intelligence that would be, I think, really interesting in the part, but apparently he has sworn that he will never read for a Sherlock Holmes part. Alas, his opportunity to play Laurie King's Sherlock Holmes is slipping past.
His loss.
Exactly.
I somehow can't see Robert Downey as my Holmes.
No. Benedict Cumberbatch, on the other hand, in a couple of years.
Oh, a couple of decades, maybe.
Would you mind talking a little bit about the book that you've edited with Les Klinger?
That's going to be fun. A Study in Sherlock, it's called. Les Klinger, of course, is the notable Sherlockian who did the 3-volume new annotated Sherlock Holmes and has been very active in my Sherlockian career, as it were. He, in fact, appears not personally but as a reference in The Art of Detection, the Kate Martinelli book with the Sherlock Holmes story in it. He is one of the expert Sherlockians that Detective Martinelli consults. So Les and I have done any number of projects and joint events over the years. We've done, I don't know, half a dozen Les and Laurie shows, we call them. He calls them Laurie and Les shows because he's a gent to his soul. But it's interesting to have a public conversation with someone who has such a very different approach to the Holmes material. You know, mine is you take it and run, and his is you write footnotes about it. So it's really great fun to do stuff, and I love Les a lot. So we agreed to do a collection of Sherlock Holmes material for the Baker Street Irregulars and called it The Grand Game, based on the idea that 100 years of Sherlockian scholarship began with Father Knox's definitive essay about Sherlock Holmes, which sets the groundwork for, you know, 100 and some years of writing about Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, the settings, Mycroft, all the different things from an academic point of view, tongue firmly in cheek. So we collected these stories and ended up with 2 volumes. The second volume will be out in time for the annual meeting in January. But the first volume is out. And I wrote an introduction to that based on categorizing the stories under Father Knox's point of view. That is, you treat it as if you were using biblical scholarship, critical scholarship. So he and I did this volume, and in the course of talking about it, we said, gee, it would be fun to get some modern take on these things, not just as an academic work, but as stories that were inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon, not by people who are generally considered Sherlockian writers, not by people who publish regularly as pastiche writers, but by people that aren't considered Sherlock Holmes fans. So between us, Les and I put together a group of names. And since he's a lawyer and I've been a writer forever, we know where all the bodies are buried, and nobody told us no. Well, one or two people told us no, but we forgave them. And ended up with this amazing collection of 18 writers who did us stories. Some of them are sort of pastiches. Some of them are the story behind the story. Some of them are modern interpretations. I mean, they're really a lovely, fascinating, exciting collection of short stories from such unexpected names as well. Neil Gaiman had written a Sherlock Holmes story that won a Hugo, A Study in Emerald. And so he wrote us a second one from a very different point of view. And Lee Child, who nobody realizes is a great fan of Conan Doyle, S.J. Roseanne, Margaret Maron. I mean, all kinds of really fascinating people have done the stories for this collection. And they'll be out the end of October in the United States. I'm not sure about UK rights. I think they've been sold, and I'm not sure the dates.
Okay. Well, I'll keep an eye open.
There is a book page. If you go onto my website, laurierking.com, there's a book page for Study in Sherlock under, I think it's under et cetera. And there's an entire website for that, which has all the information about ordering and where events are going to be and when translations come out and that kind of thing. So It's all on the web.
fabulous. We'll keep an eye out and we'll put links everywhere and direct people there.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Sounds excellent.
It is. It's a great collection.
Brilliant.
I have one more question. This is probably a very hard question to answer, but do you have a favorite of your books at this point in time?
Generally, my favorite is the one that I haven't written yet.
Oh, I like that.
Because it's just so brilliant. And then, of course, I write it, and it's not quite what I had intended it to be. But it's a nice book. But the next one will be really fantastic. I think that the one book I never hesitate to recommend to people, because an awful lot of people seem to enjoy it for a number of different reasons, is the first of the Russells, The Beekeeper's Apprentice. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that so many people from so many different walks of life have loved it means that I am permitted to recommend it.
Yes, my friends have a tradition of buying it for one another and kind of paying it forward so that more and more people come to be acquainted with The Beekeeper's Apprentice.
Ah, the first one's free.
Exactly. After that, you're hooked.
The King Contagion.
Yeah, definitely. One of our babes on the podcast, Jen, said she's reading The Moor at the moment, and she said she's getting to the point where she's thinking, I should read something other than this series, but I can't.
Well, there's only 11 books, so, you know.
Do you have another pastiche writer who you would consider to be your personal favorite?
I don't actually read a lot of Holmes pastiches, mostly because I'm afraid that they will get into my brain and I will think that it's something I wrote or something Conan Doyle wrote, and I will make reference to something that someone completely outside the canon or my stuff came up with. So I tend not to read Holmes pastiches. I think the last few that I read were those that dealt with Holmes in his age. I mean, I loved Michael Chabon's Final Solution. Yes. I thought that was just brilliant. But I don't have to worry about it interfering with how I think of the Holmes world, because it's far, far after. I don't seem to have the same problem with media. Movies and television don't seem to occupy the same part of my brain as stories do. So things that I see on the screen, I don't tend to think, oh, now did I write that? Did Conan Doyle write that? I can watch, Sherlock or the Robert Downey interpretation or Jeremy Brett or whomever, and not feel that I'm treading dangerous ground.
Interesting.
That is interesting. I would be interested because I think among Sherlockians, Ari Nadler is a figure that inspires a lot of controversy, and the question whether she is a love interest or can be a love interest or was meant to be a love interest has been debated forever. Where you stand on that debate is, I think, pretty clear. I mean, from my interpretation of Language of Bees and the fact that, spoiler, there is a son and, you know, that things happened. So what are the reasons why do you write Holmes and Adler the way you have done?
It seemed to me that having a man in his late 50s or early 60s, whatever interpretation you choose, who has never had a close relationship with a woman and who then does so with a very young woman was just a little odd. And I thought someone like that would conceivably have sought out this woman who so impressed him by getting the better of him. So that's where that idea of the two of them coming close together during the great hiatus, as they call it, came from. Because I think that looking at him as a more well-rounded individual is something that I tend to do in the books in general, whereas Conan Doyle just had this slice of Holmes's life that he was interested in looking at and didn't include things like relationships with women. To Dr. Watson's mind, Holmes simply didn't have them. But I thought that it was more likely he had them very, very limited experiences, because that's how he would demand of himself. So that's That's where that came from.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
It also kind of helps get around the problem of one of the regular questions that people ask is Russell ever going to have a baby? It seems to me there's already enough difficulty keeping the characters in control as it goes, and to introduce a child into the mix would be just more than I could deal with. I can't even manage to deal effectively with Dr. Watson. what am I going to do with a kid? So by having this sort of side family, it gets around that to some extent, so that you have a family that Russell and Holmes respectively can get involved with, but without having them always burdened by, you know, it's really difficult to just go off to Morocco and leave a kid with Mrs. Hudson.
Oh dear, can you imagine? Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, to me personally, the one question that I would have, if I had one question, would actually not be, is Russell ever going to have a baby?
Well, I suppose it is, you know, she's a young woman. And you sort of expect that that's where a marriage tends to lead. And I'm not saying that it would never happen. I just can't envision it. You know, perhaps as the end of the series, I'll write one like the Poirot series and, you know, put it in the safe to be published posthumously.
All the skeletons in the closet.
Yeah, I will saddle Russell and Holmes with a small child and end the series with that. I don't know. That'll show them.
As long as you don't end the series by killing Holmes.
I don't think we need to do that. He can easily just wander off to Tibet for a few more years.
Very true. Okay, I think that's it for me.
That's it for me.
Good.
We've managed to conquer the world of Holmesian scholarship, eh?
Pretty much, yeah. That was an absolute delight. Very, very pleased that you agreed to do this.
Certainly, I'm always happy to talk about these odd characters that my lives are involved with.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me. Baker Street babes.
Yes.
Bye-bye, ladies.
Bye.
Bye.
Super huge major thanks to Artie, Sarah, and Amy, and of course to Miss King, who did a fabulous interview. Thank you so much. You can find out more about Laurie at her website at www.lauriearking.com. On Twitter, you can also follow her, aka Mary Russell, at Mary_Russell. That's with 2 S's and 2 L's. And you can also follow Les Klinger at L Klinger. I also want to take this moment to thank you so much. We were in a bind where our upgraded bandwidth wasn't enough, and we asked for help. And within 24 hours, we made double our donation goal. Seriously, thank you so much. We can't do this without all of your help. And the amount of support has been, oh my God, I'm tearing up. Has been so touching and so fantastic. There are over 1,000 of you who listen to us, and that number is growing. And now with our partnership with Anglotopia.net, and with MX Publishing, we're going places, and I truly feel very honored to be part of this amazing Sherlock Holmes community and fandom that has been going on for over 100 years. And to be a part of that and to be growing with it is truly fantastic, and to also be a voice for younger fans and for female fans. Trust me when I say that we are flabbergasted by all of this, and you all really make this worth it. Like, we just started this as a fun little thing, and it's become so much more. Honestly, thank you. Thank you so much. We have amazing things coming. Keep posted on our website, www.bakerstreetbabes.com, on our Twitter, at BakerSTBabes, and also on our Tumblr, bakerstreetbabes.tumblr. Talk with us. Give us feedback. We love talking with all of you guys. We're starting up a Facebook page, so we'll be able to talk to you through that as well. And just really fantastic things are coming. Also, if you are in the Toronto area, I will be going to a study in Scandal in Toronto from October 13th to the 16th. And I'll be rubbing shoulders with some of the most amazing Sherlockians ever. So if you're in that area, please, please come out, and I would love to meet you. I know some followers on Twitter go to Watson Tin Box in Ellicott City. I'll be going to that dinner as well. And Artie is going to the London Expo. So make sure you go and look for Artie. They'll have pamphlets and everything for you for the Sherlock meetup. So yes, thank you so much. We love you so, so much. Oh my God, guys. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
A reminder that you can help save Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's home in Hindhead, Surrey by supporting the Undershaw Preservation Trust. It was at Undershaw that he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles and The Return of Sherlock Holmes and entertained many notable people, including Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, J.M. Barrie, the creator of Peter Pan, and the young Virginia Woolf. Today, Undershaw stands sorrowfully empty, neglected, and vandalized. Waverly Borough Council have granted the owners planning permission to carve up the literary historic house into three flats with five more homes built on its side. Modern townhouses, or maintained as the single dwelling that Conan Doyle designed and had built. The Undershaw Preservation Trust is vigorously working towards the latter, and you can help by visiting www.saveundershaw.com, as well as following them on Twitter and joining their Facebook campaign. Thank you.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?